This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and 12-step the good news of 12-step recovery. Hi, everybody. I'd like to acknowledge, thanks for tuning in. I'd like to acknowledge Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse in Nashville on WNAH out of Nashville. There, it's a AM station that broadcasts us live over the airwaves, parts of Arkansas and Kentucky. About a million households have the ability to tune in and get the good news of 12-step recovery. 12-step recovery is the repentance process, if you missed the boat on that deal. It's how we get and give satisfaction in life, is to find out what our problem is and how to resolve it and have a spiritual awakening. I'd like to thank Recovery Today magazine. It's recovery.net. They have a free magazine article that you can find on the internet at recoverytoday.net. They've just posted one of our stories, Spiritus Contra Spiritum, which is spirits in the ravages of spirits, how we deal with alcohol and the spiritual malady. I want to acknowledge our co-host, Harold B., who is a family counselor professional, goes around and helps families with their problems, and he's also helps the mentally poor. My understanding is that when you're poor, you're crazy. Only the rich can afford to be eccentric. Harold?
Yes, hi, everybody. And the main reason I'm here is because I've been blessed by God with years and years of recovery, over two decades. And indeed, the key to the whole thing is intensive work with another alcoholic. I'm here as a recovering person, not as a professional, but I enjoy following and reading Joseph's work. He writes articles and publishes the website rumradio.org. It's all about working with others and the spirit of sponsorship. And is I'll let him explain how widely distributed the good work is. And I just wanted to mention that he doesn't make a dime off of that website. It's all his giving back and service work. In fact, he spent many hundreds of dollars to get it into the shape it is so that it operates correctly. And I admire that. So everybody go to your computers, tune in to rumradio.org, and you can follow along with what we're presenting tonight as a topic. And we'll also give you the phone number so you can call in and join the conversation. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. Yeah, the phone number, if you'd like to call in and you have questions or experiences, you know, we call it in the program Experience, Strength, and Hope. What it was like, what happened, and what is like now, in a general way, according to the topic, if possible. The phone number, call in, is 949-534-0621. Again, the guest call in is 949-534-0621. Rum Radio is in 118 plus foreign countries, including Mississippi. We've had 1,554 towns and cities tune into us. Now, that's a little grandiose. I think about 600 of those 1,500 is one person. We're about 2.5 years old, and it's moving like right along. Most of it's from word of mouth. We've had approaching 96,000, probably as of right now, we have just 96,000 hits to the website, and we've gotten over 1,100 letters and notes from around the world thanking us for the work. No money is being made. We hold to the 11th tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the principle of anonymity. We remain anonymous. We use our last initial according to the traditions, which is part of the understanding of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the credit for this work goes to God and the fellowship, which produced this information. Tonight we're going to be talking about, I have it as down as Twain, Tradition 2. Now, you got to remember, last week's broadcast we had was Pushing the Envelope, was the beginning structure of the traditions. Dr. Bob's reluctance to sign off on the traditions and his argument against it was basically putting authority where no authority existed, one. And two, he was afraid that we already had sufficient information to make this thing work. Dr. Bob had sponsored 5,000 men. Did you know that, Harold?
That is really impressive. I think it's important to keep that in mind.
I had wrote one of the articles I wrote was if Bill was the sail, Dr. Bob was the anchor. Bill was the front man. He was out there promoting. He was the promoter. He was a natural promoter, just was. That was his ability. And Dr. Bob was really the quiet kind of guy, a Vermont Yankee, big hands, a doctor, and he took this thing one guy at a time. Bill was trying to change the world. Dr. Bob was changing the world one man at a time. I really believe that if you think you're going to change the world, it's either grandiose romanticism or politics. If you want to change the world, it's one man at a time. And that was Dr. Bob's view. He was trying to do this thing one step at a time, one man at a time. And 5,000 men, they went through the steps pretty quickly. Just think about it, 5,000 guys, it's, you know, takes your breath away just imagining that. But they went through the steps pretty quick, and they got the next guy out working with a new prospect. And I think we've lost something in the translation over the years. And that's part of what Rum Radio is all about, getting back into a basics approach, working the steps, and helping and extending the hand of AA to the alcoholic who still suffers in a timely manner. Twain, Tradition 2, for our group purpose, there's but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. That's the short form. Now there's a long form. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Actually, the long form is shorter than the short form. I just noticed that. Where does AA get his direction? Who runs it? This, too, is a puzzler. For every friend and newcomer, when told that our society has no president, having authority to govern it, no treasurer who can compel the payment of any dues, no board of directors who can cast an erring member into outer darkness, when indeed no AA can give another a directive and enforce obedience. Our friends gasp and explain, this simply can't be. There must be an angle somewhere. These practical folks then read Tradition 2 and learn that the sole authority in AA is a loving God, as he may express himself in the group conscience. They dubiously ask an experienced AA member if it really works. The member, sane to all appearances, immediately answers, yes. It definitely does. The friends mutter that this looks a vague, nebulous, pretty naive to them. Then they commence to watch us with speculative eyes, pick up a fragment of AA history, and soon have the solid facts. Harold?
Well, this tradition and step 11, when properly understood, really inspire me a great deal. It on step 11, which reads, sought through prayer and meditation to increase our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry it out. It took me 17 years to figure out the word us. I thought it said me. In casual reading, it seems it works okay to with the word me there, but it says us. And then what really helped me understand that is tradition two, where we read that there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group. And so what I valued most about my experience in the 12-step meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous is that we are allowed to adopt a higher power, God, as we understood God. And so I had some troubles at first, wondering, am I going to be expected to adopt someone else's God? But the group insisted, no, you're able to choose your own higher power, a power greater than yourself. My first sponsor was about 6'5", 295. I realized he was a power greater than me. But most of all, the group itself became my higher power. That's what worked best. I think what worked least was adopting my first wife as my higher power. That wasn't such a hot idea. And I paid dearly for that later. So with the group as my higher power, and as you often say, Joseph, working with others, when we're working with others, aren't we serving God? So this all came together as I realized that tradition two, there's but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group. There were many times when I needed a higher idea. I needed a different perspective. My own thoughts had gotten me into great trouble. So I checked. My sponsor said, check everything with the group. Make no decision alone. Check with the group. So the group is a higher power, and God expressing himself in our group made total sense, and it still makes sense. In fact, the longer I serve in AA, the more I see that God often talks through the voices of people all around me, and it is truly fascinating. And I'm every day there's something that happens that where God is tapping me on the shoulder and saying, I'm right here. All you have to do is ask, seek, and knock. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. I think it's good to explain what they mean by a group conscience. It's the group. It's the collective personality of the group. Each group is autonomous unto itself, and they're not actually beholding even to the GSO, General Service Organization in New York, which is the headquarters for AA, I believe, in the United States. Different countries have their own GSO, but that's sort of the New York GSO is sort of like the hubcap of this wheel. So, and each group, you know, might be different group might be lawyers or doctors or blue collar workers, and you know, the whole gambit. Sometimes there's the gay and lesbian lambda. They have certain personalities, and that collective personality is called a group conscience. What are these facts of AA life which brought us to the apparently impractical principle? We are an unruly lot. Our only hope and direction had to come from a power greater than ourselves, expressed in the collective personalities that constitute an informed group conscience. We had to defer to God. We have to be humble enough to accept the will of God when and how he expressed himself for the good of the many would ultimately ensure the good as few as the one. Where there is authority, there is no freedom. That was written by Peter Kropotkin. Where there is no authority, there is no freedom. Where there is authority, there is no freedom. To the sober person, adventurous conduct often seems insanity. Did I say that again? To the sober person, adventurous conduct often seems insanity. You know who wrote that? Aristotle.
Wow.
Yeah. To the sober person, adventurous conduct often seems insanity. Aristotle. In the language, our God, he wants us to learn to speak. It's the posture in life our God invites us to take when, as we live our lives, we encounter things we're not sure of. Crisis that threatens to overwhelm us, or pain so deep that we feel it will destroy us. It's the posture, not of cocky self-confidence, nor of indifference to the hard stuff of life, but to the humble trust and submission to the will of an almighty God who we know loves us and will care for us once we concede that God's in charge. Our collective experience has confirmed this fact. Harold?
Well, that's really powerful, and this is a good time perhaps to interject some current events. We talk about cocky self-confidence, or as I refer to it often, as overconfidence. So many of my friends, and there have been times where I myself have been overconfident, and if it weren't for the group helping me test the ideas and see that they measure up in the world of recovery, I would have been dead quite some time ago. Overconfidence is, I think, one of my biggest downfalls, and it occurs when things are going extremely well, and often that's a bigger problem for me than when a project falls apart. I might be tempted to drink when things fall apart, but I've found that I'm really tempted to drink when there's total success, everything's going great, and there's the voice of the enemy which says, hey, this might be a time to celebrate. And I also, in the past, have been overconfident about my ability to control this thing, when actually every day sober is a gift from God. It's not something I'm doing. So, and I think current events-wise, I was listening to Whitney Houston interviewed by Diane Sawyer and a couple of years ago, and Whitney indeed had that air of overconfidence. I'm going to beat this thing. I don't have to succumb to this. I've got the willpower, and even though she seemed to, on one hand, be a very spiritual person, that overconfidence really cut through the things she was saying and left me with such a sadness, because I think maybe she was caught unaware and was not totally informed about the danger of combining pills with alcohol, and I think that's what took her life, and it just struck me so hard how that overconfidence played into her demise. It's such a sad situation, but if we are wise and will determined that we're going to learn something from this tragedy, I think we can add meaning to her death if we take away a lesson that helps us live a life in recovery. We can add some meaning to her death, and it doesn't have to be in vain. I'm constantly trying to be aware of that overconfidence and on the lookout for that as a this is a spiritual warfare, and that's one of the tools of the enemy. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. It really boils down sometimes to humility. If you look at all the steps, they all have a certain component of humility involved. Three,
amen.
Our will and our lives over to the care of God. Step one, acknowledging that there is a problem and that there is a problem. Step two is that when we admit defeat in step one, that's the first humility. Two, acknowledging that God can handle it or something other than ourselves, it's humility. If you look at every step, there's humility involved. And what I've discovered, certain things about humility, one is that it's not thinking about less of yourself. It's about thinking of yourself less. Having room for the other person in there and getting out of your own head. Cockiness really is a ego with a low self-esteem. Egomaniacs with low self-esteem. You know, we keep saying, we can do this. I have the willpower. I can do this. And pride. Pride is the number one deadly sin because it disavows the existence of God. I don't need God. I have my pride. I have my willpower. I can do this on my own. I become the God of my own understanding, and I walk by the light of my own fire, even when it singes me to the bone.
Self-reliance is the tool of the enemy. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. We're not always aware of his presence, which is God, and his blessings. That's because it's so hard to break the habit that comes so naturally to us. Natural man has been an enemy to God and has been so since the beginning. Of worry and anxiety, of fretting and stewing, of taking matters into our own hands, and if we were in charge of our destiny, as if we were in charge of our destiny and future. Outer darkness means to be cast out of the fellowship of the Spirit, to be banished to the isolation of the lonely and cold mean streets. When an alcoholic is left to their own devices without the encouragement and support that only the group's interaction through and with a higher power can provide, that is when the alcoholic oftentimes loses the ability to extinguish the craving and will attempt relief that comes from the ease and comfort that is common to the first drink of alcohol. I think I went to outer darkness once. I think I was all alone. All I could see was mountains of regret swimming in an ocean of tears with spewing volcanoes of self-contempt. Somehow I knew I wasn't in Hawaii. Harold?
Wow, this is really hard-hitting. And I think in the past I've mentioned that I grew up with three brothers, and Mom used to teach us what I call the Muhammad Ali approach. I'm the greatest. I can do anything I set my mind to. And that was not a good recipe for me, not a good recipe for success. I really give thanks to God that somehow I found my way back to relying on God, relying on God's strength, not being so self-reliant. And that's really the key to my recovery, is turning away from self-reliance, turning toward God, asking every morning, constantly throughout the day, I'm asking, okay, what do you want me to do now, God? Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. John Doe, a good AA, moves to, let us say, Middletown, USA. Alone now. He reflects that he may not be able to stay sober or even alive unless he passes on to another alcoholic what was so freely given him. He feels a spiritual and ethical compulsion because hundreds may be suffering within reach of his help. Then, too, he misses his home group. He needs other alcoholics as much as they need him. He visits preachers, doctors, editors, policemen, and bartenders, with the result that Milton now has a group, and he is the founder. Pioneers may be picturesque figures, but they are often rather lonely ones until the first knock on the door. Now there's two to call upon God. Dr. Bob asked Bill W., can I give you 15 minutes? I've taken the cure. Dr. Bob's telling Bill, I'm going to give you 15 minutes to talk to me. That's it. And Dr. Bob goes on, I've taken the cure. I've been prayed over. I've been sliced and diced more than a Christmas turkey. What can you tell me in 15 minutes that will keep me sober? Bill W. replied, I'm here to keep me sober. When two gather, having no other affiliation, could call themselves an AA group. And the scripture is really close to that. When two or three are gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them, in James Version. Harold?
Absolutely. I don't think I've told my airport story on the air, but it's something that really added to my recovery and changed my life. I was at the Portland International Airport to pick someone up, and over the loudspeaker came an announcement, would a friend of Bill W. please come to the information desk? Would a friend of Bill W. please come to the information desk? And I realized that someone in recovery was needing a little help, needing to talk to some people. So I showed up at the information desk. There were about a half a dozen of us, and we had a little meeting right there. It's so fantastic to go to any country in the world, and you can find a 12-step group there and feel as though you've walked into your family again and you've got something in common with those, and it's immediate brotherhood. It's just fantastic and nothing like it anywhere else in the world. It's really a value to me. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. Let me give you the call and the number in case you'd like to call. It's 949-534-0621. Again, 949-534-0621. John is the go-to guy. All questions deferred to him. This is his baby. He is the captain of the ship and his first loyal followers, his board of directors. Being the founder, he is the first, the boss. Who else could be? Very soon, though, he assumed authority to run everything, begins to be shared with the first alcoholics he has helped. At this moment, the benign dictator becomes the chairman of a committee composed of his friends. These are the growing group's hierarchy of service, self-appointed. Of course, because there's no one other way. How else are you going to do it? This is the only people there. In a matter of months, AA booms in Middleton. Life will take on a new meaning to watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. Harold?
This is, I've been honored to see some groups started up, and it's just great to, it's amazing how it works. I went to the university. My favorite type of therapy is group therapy, and I'm a facilitator for several groups now. But at the universities all over the world, they study group dynamics and what makes groups successful, what are some of the pitfalls, and for years, decades, they've studied AA, still don't understand how they work, but they recognize that they work better than anything else in existence. They just don't, they can't figure out why. So I'm honored to be on both sides of it. We do professional groups, but I still find that the AA group, because the service work and the leadership is rotating, they have the best results of all, bar none. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. People who enjoy being in charge should not be in charge of anything. We have learned by sad experience that is the nature and disposition of almost all men. As soon as they get a little authority, as they suppose, they will immediately begin to exercise unrighteous dominion and the illusion of control. Growing pains now beset the group. Panhandlers panhandle. Lonely hearts pine. Problems descend like an avalanche. Still more important, murmurs are heard in the body politic, which swell into a loud cry. Do these old-timers think they can run this group forever? Let us have an election. The founder and his friends are hurt and depressed. They rush from crisis to crisis and from member to member, pleading, but it's no use. The revolution is on. The group conscience is about to take over. Revolution is an abrupt change in the form of government. Ambrose Bierce. Most people try to live life by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If only his arrangements would stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He might be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he is more likely to have varied traits. Is he not a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of delusion that he can wrestle satisfaction and happiness out of this life if he only manages well? Harold?
That really is what it boils down to. People that are self-reliant are quite convinced that they're capable of handling everything just fine. They don't need God. They sense that they don't need other people. And this is a we program. I need everybody else in order to make my recovery strong and vital and a living thing. So self-reliance is the thing that, well, I had a friend a couple of years ago, 22 years clean and sober, and he got the enemy voice was saying, "You're self-reliant. Look at you. You're great. You're good. You're great stuff. You're hot stuff. You've got this thing licked. You're self-reliant." And within 6 months, he had lost his job, his house, his car, his family, was living in his mom's basement, and died of an overdose. Mm-hmm. So self-reliance is a killer. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. Now comes the election. If the founder and his friends have served well, they may be, to their surprise, be reinstated for a time. If, however, they have heavily resisted the rising tide of democracy, they may be summarily beached. In either case, the group now has so-called rotating committee, very sharply limited in its authority, and no sense whatever can its members govern or direct the group. They are servants. There is to be sometimes a thankless privilege of doing the group's chores, headed by the chairman. They look after public relations and arrange meetings. They are treasurers, strictly accountable, takes money from the hat that is passed, banks it, pays the rent and other bills, and makes a regular report at a business meeting. The secretary sees that literature is on the table, looks after the phone answering service, answers the mail, and sends out notices of meetings, such as the simple service that enables the group to function. The committee gives no spiritual advice, judge no one's conduct, issues no orders. Every one of them may be promptly eliminated at the next election if they try this, and so they make the belated discovery that they are really servants, not senators. These are universal experiences. Thus, throughout AA, does this group conscience decree the terms upon which its leaders shall serve. People do not care how much you know until they know how much you care. John C. Maxwell. Servant leadership of any group will see herself or himself as a servant of that group and will act accordingly. M. Scott Peck. Harold?
These are terrific. Dr. Peck is one of my favorite authors, and you listeners might recognize him as the author of The Road Less Traveled, and then a more recent book called Further Along the Road Less Traveled, a wonderful, wonderful work added to the first. You really should have both of them together. But he also has a number of books about groups and leadership and communities, recovery communities and so forth. And I think one of his books is titled Servant Leadership. And he very carefully and lovingly describes how servant leadership works. And that's really the key to AA, is that the leaders are servants, not governors, not senators. Very, very important. And people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. That's really a guideline that I try to think about every day. And letting people know that they're appreciated and how much I care is something that I spend part of every day trying to do. Serving they mention here in the article that being part of the service committee at an AA group is a thankless job, but really looking deeper into it, that doing service work is one of the key elements to having a strong program of recovery. So there's not a lot of recognition, but the payoff is great as far as a recovery life that's vital and growing. Joseph?
Thank you. Oftentimes, a thankless job that most do not have the insight to acknowledge the tireless effort, time, and sacrifice of they who work behind the limelight and the grandstand. All that is known is that somehow it all gets done, and it's steady as she goes. It's only noticed when the door is locked and posted closed, and there's nowhere else to go. So I put this in there. It's not my job to steer the ship. The horn I'll never blow. It's not my place to say how far the ship's allowed to go. I'm not allowed to go on deck or even clang the bell. But if this damn thing starts to sink, just watch who catches hell. Thank you. This brings
That's
us straight
terrific.
To the question. Thank you. This brings us straight to the question, does AA have a real leadership? Most emphatically, the answer is yes, notwithstanding the apparent lack of it. Let's turn again to the deposed founder and his friends. when what becomes of them. As their grief and anxiety wear away, a subtle change begins. Ultimately, they divide into two classes known as, in AA slang, the elder statesman is the one who sees the wisdom of the group's decision, who holds no resentment over his reduced status, whose judgment, fortified by considerable experience, is sound, who is willing to sit quietly on the sidelines, patiently awaiting developments. The bleeding beacon is the one who just as surely convinced that the group cannot get along without him, who constantly convives for re-election office, and who continues to be consumed with self-pity. Self-pity is one of the most dangerous forms of self-centeredness. It fogs life's mirror and bleeds the scorn filled soul. Harold?
I love that description. It fogs life's mirror. Self-pity. That was one of my character defects. I used to have some wonderful pity parties, and it was always poor me, poor me, pour me a drink. But it's so freeing to be away from that, and looking back on it, it's pretty embarrassing. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. A few hemorrhage so badly that drained of all A spirit and principles, they get drunk. At times, the AA landscape seems to be littered with bleeding forms. Nearly every old-timer in our society has gone through this process in some degree. Happily, most of them survive and live to become elder statesmen. They become the real and permanent leadership of AA. There is the quiet opinion that sure knowledge and humble example that resolve a crisis. When sorely perplexed, the group inevitably turns to them for advice. They become the voice of the group conscience. In fact, these are the true voices of Alcoholics Anonymous. They do not drive by mandate. They lead by example. This is the experience which led us to the conclusion that our group conscience, well advised by its elders, will be in the long run wiser than any single leader. A good head and a good heart are always a formidable combination. Nelson Mandela. When AA was only 3 years old, an event occurred demonstrating this principle. One of the first members, AA, entirely contrary to his own desires, was obliged to conform to group opinion. Here is the story in his words. One day I was doing a 12-step job at a hospital in New York. The proprietor, Charlie, summoned me to his office. "Bill," he said, "I think it's a shame that you are financially so hard up. All around you, these drunks are getting well and making money. But you're giving this work full time and you're broke. It isn't fair." Charlie finished in his desk and came up with an old financial statement, handing it to me. He continued, "This shows the kind of money the hospital used to make back in the 1920s, thousands of dollars a month. It should be doing just as well now, and it should, and it would, if only you'd help me. So why don't you move your work in here? I'll give you an office, a decent drawing account, and a very healthy slice of the profits." 3 years ago, when my head doctor, Silkworth, began to tell me of the idea of helping drunks by spirituality, I thought it was a crackpot stuff, but I've changed my mind. Someday, this bunch of ex-drunks of yours will be Madison Square Garden, will fill Madison Square Garden, and I don't see why you shouldn't starve meanwhile, why you should starve in the meanwhile. While I propose is perfectly ethical, you'd become a lay therapist and more successful than anybody in the business. Bill, here's your chance for the house on the hill, the new car, and the recognition you richly deserve, and not to mention the fact of how many more alcoholics you can help. And don't forget Lois, who has been dutifully by your side. You can give her a home. She can call her own. I dramatized a little bit, but that's basically what it was. I was bowled over. There was a few twinges of consciousness until I saw how really ethical Charlie's proposal was. There was nothing wrong, whatever, with becoming a lay therapist. I thought of Lois as coming home exhausted from the department store each day, only to cook supper for a house full of drunks who weren't paying board. I thought of the large sum of money still owing my Wall Street creditors. I thought of a few of my alcoholic friends who were making as much money as ever. Why shouldn't I do as well as they? The man who acquires the ability to take full possession of his own mind may take possession of anything else to which he is justly entitled. Andrew Carnegie. Harold?
Wow, that's terrific. This is like a trip back through time, a chance to listen to Bill as he's thinking through these decisions and working on these principles.
I fluffed it up a little bit. I have the tradition as outlined, but I put little fluffs in there in between, little dramatizations to increase the point.
Yes.
You know, that part about
I like it.
Yeah. I stay to the spirit of it. All right, so where were we? Okay. Although I asked Charlie time to consider if my own mind was about made up, racing back to Brooklyn, that's where I was born, on the subway, I had a seemingly flash of divine guidance. It was only a simple sentence, but most convincing. In fact, it came right out of the Bible. A voice kept saying to me, "The laborer is worthy of his hire." Ministers use that a lot.
Yes.
Arriving home, I found Lois cooking as usual, while three drunks looked hungrily on from the kitchen door. I drew her aside and told the glorious news. She looked interested, but not as excited as I thought she would be. It was meeting night, although none of the alcoholics we boarded seemed to get sober. Some others had. With their wives, they crowded into our downstairs parlor. At once, I burst into the story of my opportunity. Never shall I forget their impassive faces and the steady gaze they focused upon me with waning enthusiasm. My tale trailed off to the end. There was a long silence. Silence is the true friend that never betrays. Confucius. Should I continue, Harold? Do you have something?
No, go ahead and continue. This is really nicely done.
Almost timidly, one of my friends began to speak. We know how hard up you are, Bill. It bothers us a lot. We've often wondered what we might do about it, but I think I speak for everyone here when I say that what you now propose bothers us an awful lot more. The speaker's voice grew more confident. Don't you realize, he went on, that you can never become a professional? As generous as Charlie has been to us, don't you see that we can't tie this thing up with a hospital or any other? You tell us that Charlie proposed is ethical. Sure, it's ethical, but what if we got won't run our ethics only? It has to be better. Sure, Charlie's idea is good, but it isn't good enough. This is a matter of life and death, Bill. And nothing but the very best will do. Challengingly, my friends looked at me as their spokesman continued. Bill, haven't you often said right here in this meeting that sometimes the good is the enemy of the best? Well, this is a plain case of it. You can't do this thing to us. So spoke the group conscience. The group was right, and I was wrong. The voice on the subway was not the voice of God. Here was the true voice welling up out of my friends. I listened, and thank God I obeyed. A life lived with integrity, even if it lacks the trappings of fame and fortune, is a shining star whose light others may follow in the years to come. Dennis Waitley. Anything, Harold?
Boy, this is really terrific. And as I mentioned earlier, very often our friends in the program are, through their voices, God speaks. And the line I like best is the one, sometimes the good is the enemy of the best. Sometimes we do have to give up the good in order to be able to apprehend the better. And it's an important principle, and it only really comes into focus when we can discuss it as a group. This is a we program, and that's one of the ideas that really helps when it's a we discovery. Joseph?
Thank you, Harold. I think it's important to look at the picture, too. With the traditions are pretty simply laid out. I've put some of the other parts of the big book and the 12 steps in there to amplify the understanding. I think it's good to remember to see Bill's personality a little bit, how this was really a test for him, big time.
Yes.
You know, he was a man on a mission. He was a man that felt that eventually he would attain the house on the hill, that he was going to be acknowledged as someone important, wealthy, a man of reckoning. And so when this opportunity came along, and he was hurting, you know, financially, they were just barely squeaking by. Things were, you know, business wasn't good. You've got to remember, this is depression time.
Yes.
It was a big deal to put, in one of the traditions that goes into it, he was going to put like a 50-cent piece or a quarter into the hat going around, and he fished back and grabbed a dime. And that was the average take at the time, was 10 and 15 cents. A quarter was like, you know, putting a $5 bill in there. So if you got to remember, money doubles every 10 years. So since 1935, if money doubles, that would be about $2 or $3, putting a dime in the hat, which was, you know, there was a lot of money. Most people weren't working. These were alcoholics. These were Skid Row folks, people out of the hospitals. Once they got their act together and went back to work, some of them started. I've seen guys come from nothing to superstar in less than 5 years. I mean, really wealthy people. It's like amazingly so. You know, some of us, you know, we trot along and we do the best we can. Some of us never catch back up again. You know, we don't have the money that we had at one time, or whatever reason. It's just different people, different things. But so when Bill was offered this professional standing where he could give Lois her home and have the car and, you know, and have the house on the hill to some degree, and still be able to help more alcoholics, more drunks could be held, that was a big decision. On his own devices, he would have went for it. If the group conscience didn't speak at that time, I'm very confident that Bill probably would have went that way. You know, he was on the impression God had spoken to him. Yeah, it's okay. You can do this. It's going to help a lot more people.
Yeah.
So a lot of the argument is professionalism. I've been accused of that with Rum Radio, because on my recovery card I have Stepologist. And a group conscience took me to task, and somebody said, Stepologist? Oh, well, he's trying to professionalize the steps. And, I know. And then and there was a fella in there from another group just visiting, and he happened to go into the group conscience. He was new or what have you. And he says, no. He said, that's a joke. And the guys who had a hard time with it turned around and said, we don't see the humor. So I thought that was interesting. We're very sensitive about people making money in AA to some degree. But I've known some that have had recovery houses, halfway houses, three-quarter houses, and have made money doing that. And, you know, we don't really question that. That's not AA. But for me, I don't believe in making money on AA. I can make money other ways, but I don't believe in making money in AA. And if you take the money out of the equation, I don't see where the professionalism comes from. Do you, Harold?
Well, that's the thing. The ability to, I mean, the group is self-sustaining by our own contributions. We're not sponsored by anyone. And the group is allowed to hire service people to do certain things. But as far as going out and then charging people for recovery ideas, that's where we have to draw the line. And I can perfectly see why that's important. And one of the biggest controversies is treatment programs. And I think that's been the source of a lot of confusion. But still, the 12-step meetings, there are no dues or fees. We do pass a basket. We're self-sustaining with our own contributions. The money goes to pay the rent and the lights. And if you can put money in the basket, great. If you can't, you're still welcome. So as far as professionalism, and I think the real problem arises when there's a conflict of interest, that if a person gets better, is ready to graduate and leave, along with him, their money leaves. So will the professional try to keep them in treatment beyond the time that they need it? That's the ethical question, and AA avoids that. We've got about 3 minutes for the regular program and the radio broadcast.
Right. Well, I think we could finish it up in three.
Great.
Because actually, we finished it with the last words on the tradition is, thank God I obeyed. That was the end of it. And then I put that, and then I have this. And I think this is where Bill really came in, and Dr. Bob, to laugh often and much, to win the respect of intelligent people and the affection of children, to earn the appreciation of honest critics, and to endure the betrayal of false friends, to appreciate beauty, to find the best in others, to leave the world a bit better, whether by a healthy child, a garden patch, or a redeemed social condition, to know even one life has breathed easier because you have lived. This is to have succeeded. Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Wow, that's wonderful.
So, and this is where that we look. Bill and Bob had manifested this self. Their deal was, they were on a mission now, and God was in charge. So they weren't looking for wealth or even notoriety. Bill turned down a Life magazine portrait and an article because of anonymity. Dr. Bob said this, there's two ways we break anonymity. One is in press, radio, and films. And the other way was that if we were so anonymous that another drunk couldn't find us. Harold, you got any last thoughts?
Well, that sums it up. Great job on these traditions and great job on rumradio.org.
Thank you. The traditions were kind of a challenge. I labored mightily even just thinking about trying to tackle something so simple without complicating it and just amplifying the ideas and make them a little bit more understanding to the general public. So this work is an effort of love, and it's to help the next sufferer, and that's it. That's the goal, is to help the next part. Our numbers are coming up, and hopefully this will do the job which has been intended for it to do. So thank you, Harold, for your efforts and your time. And like to say, remember, folks, it's rumradio.org. You'll find a lot of really good information. And when you do, open your mouth and please pass it on.
Thanks,
everybody.
Have a good night.
Good night.